nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So today, we'll be talking about the defects that are responsible for gate dielectric breakdown. Now, the term TDDB often sounds cryptic. TDDB stands for time-dependent dielectric breakdown. It is slightly different from what people used to do in the old days. They would take a oxide and then they will ramp the voltage and ask at what point the newer transistor or the oxide fails. They'll just keep increasing the voltage from 0 volt to 25 volts, 50 volts, 100 volts, whatever. And then whatever voltage it failed, they will divide it by the oxide thickness and call it the breakdown field. If you look at SMZ and other books, you will see something like breakdown field. But TDDB is different. TDDB is you apply a voltage and sit there until it fails. You are interested in the time. You don't change the voltage. So this is a different class of test, and all modern dielectric tests are done by time-dependent dielectric breakdown, not ramp test. Ramp test really doesn't mean anything. So I wish to talk about the defects. In the last class, we discussed that there's red boxes within the oxide. They get generated randomly. And at some point, the couple of boxes, red boxes, they line up, right? And from the substrate to the gate, there is a short, and that leads to dielectric breakdown. But how do you get the properties of those red boxes? How many there are? What are their energy levels? How do you know that? Because that's very important. Whether once they line up, whether they are going to make it short or not, depends on whether what the defect levels are. So before going any further, I want to tell you a little bit about how you make those characterizations. And there are various techniques. You know, you trace at green boxes, 110, 100 seconds and all, and periodically stop. And we have already heard about charge pumping, DCIV method, subthreshold method, and primarily those methods are related to interface defects. Today, the defects I'm going to talk about are bulk defects that are inside the oxide. So charge pumping, general normal charge pumping or DCIV will not catch them. So let's talk about the types of, I'm going to tell you about three methods. All give slightly different information about these defects. And then subsequently in the other lectures, I will then start talking about when they break down, the failure statistics and all those things in the subsequent lectures. But today on defect characterization. And in particular, I'm going to talk about this VT effect, threshold voltage effect. It's like a CV, but with a special technique. Stress-induced leakage current is called the SILC, quantum yield experiment, and not SDR. I think SDR can one generally do only close to the interface, right? SDR is spin-dependent recombination. But essentially, let me talk about these three things. Quantum yield is the number of holes generated per injected electron. Remember, in the anode hole case, that's the primary quantity. Just like the substrate current is a thermometer. Similarly, quantum yield says how many holes are going to go back and attack the oxide. So therefore, quantum yield is a important measurement metric. So we'll go through them one at a time. The first method is a CV method, but with a special twist. Let's assume that you are stressing an oxide. Remember, you are stressing it for 1 second, 10 seconds, 100 seconds. So this is one of those stress period. You have applied, this is an NMOS. You have applied a certain gate voltage, and the defects are forming within the oxide. So this is a stress period. Now, what you want to stop at a certain time and then see how many defects you have accumulated. Because many times at low voltages, you'll never go to failure. So you want to project it long time. So you want to see how the defects are accumulating up. And how do you do that? So here is the technique. So the red small line that I just saw, let's say that's the defect. And you are generating defects, 1, 2, 5, 10, whatever number of defects you are generating. Then what you do, you stop. You prepare for measurement. And then you push the substrate and push it a high value. but reduce the gate voltage. Reduce the gate voltage. I'm doing measurement. Reduce the gate voltage, but increase the substrate voltage. What will happen? You can see that through the jagged line, that from the top, from the N silicon on the left, right, and through the P silicon body, the electron is going to get injected within the oxide. However, remember the gate voltage is smaller, so no additional traps are being generated. However, the electrons that are in there, get coming from the body, are now going to get trapped in the existing defects. And by trapping in the existing defects, then you can cause a threshold voltage shift. So it is like coloring. You know, you want to, let's say, in this case, lot of electron current is flowing. You cannot see the traps. Threshold voltage is shifting a little bit. But you remember the threshold voltage shift is generally minuscule, very small. However, by reducing the voltage on the right-hand side and injecting a lot of current and trapping them, you can amplify the voltage, that the CV shift that you have. And in that case, what will happen? So these electrons, essentially, these are the band diagram. This is the Fowler-Nordheim tunneling on the left. This is what happens during stress, let's say, on the left-hand side. During stress, you have applied a voltage. But what you can do is substrate hot electron, SHE. So that is through the injector, you can essentially inject a lot of electrons, and therefore in the middle panel. And therefore, if there are defects which have formed, then all those defects will get charged. You see the problem? If you had a defect created up here, or up here, which is above the Fowler-Nordheim regime, the Fowler-Nordheim regime wouldn't have seen those. But by injecting it over the barrier, by using a substrate injection, you can color them all. Now you will see them all, because the CV will now see them. And once you do that, what you will see, so this is, will be called a filling step. This injection from the left will be calling a filling step, and the filling step will essentially give you a CV shift. And then, yes.
This technique, can it separate the interface from the bulk?
No, cannot separate between interface and trap. But you are absolutely right. But the thing is, the bulk will have many more compared to the interface. So therefore, primarily, it will be bulk trap dominated. Yes, you are right. There will be other techniques I'll show. So what happens that electron fluence is really like time. It's the integration over time. If the gate current is constant during stress, because you are stressing at a constant voltage, so the current must be constant during stress. So you integrate up to a certain point, and then when you do the filling, the threshold voltage jumps up, right? The threshold voltage jumps up because you have injected a lot of electron and have filled them all up. And so thereby, you can count how many defects have been generated. And you can do that in various ways. You can stress at different conditions. On the bottom, you see that there are various types of stress you can have, different types of filling factor you can have, just to make sure by doing different measurements, you are catching the same number of traps, right? You can fill it by different filling factor, voltage also. And you can see they are depending on, they essentially all line up, right? You have three different stress conditions. That's this corresponding defect generation as a function of time. So this could be square root of T or the universal curve that you know about during hot carrier degradation. Whatever that curve is, this is how you essentially trace out the defect generation. So this is one method, widely used and meant for bulk trap generation, simple method. What is the problem? You need a bulk injector. So if you had a SO high substrate, silicon uninsulator, which you didn't have a bulk injector, you are dead, because of course then you cannot inject it. You need a separate body contact which can be pushed up and the carriers can be injected. But you can have test structures, that's not a problem. The second method, which is specially suited for bulk trap characterization, is called a stress-induced leakage method, leakage current method. This is specifically good for oxides which are between 1.5 to 6 nanometer. within that range. And you will explain, understand in a second. You cannot use it for very thin oxide, 1.1 nanometer. This will not work. There's a slightly different technique. I'll tell you that. But in general, for thin oxide, this method works. For very thick oxide, cannot do it. You cannot do this method, like 10 nanometer, 20 nanometer, cannot use this method to do this. Then do the other method, the charging method. So how does it work? Works very simply. You see what happens, that in this particular curve, I told you that the gate current, when you're stressing as a function of gate, as a function of time, then I said the gate current remains more or less constant. That's the black horizontal line. Until the breakdown, and the breakdown, I am showing you multiple steps, because what happens that once the first breakdown happens, so much heat is generated that nearby there are other regions also get heated. And so subsequently you have one breakdown, two breakdown, three breakdown. You quickly have many breakdowns around it because so much heat is generated. And I told you about that, the consequence of this defect generated. Yes. So those we'll discuss in the 3-4 lectures down, all this physics about. Right now, we are just staying below this time, below the volcano eruption. After the what happens in the volcano eruption, that we'll discuss. Depends on how much, what was your stress voltage, how much power went through it. Yes.
In the first lecture, when you were talking about, you said, in thin defects, they're generally uncorrelated.
Yes, generally they are uncorrelated, but that depends on the voltage. If you apply 10 volts on a thin, that will become correlated. So there is no a priori condition that in thin oxide is equal to uncorrelated. Not. The thin oxide generally have lower voltages, therefore it's uncorrelated. If the thick oxide also had very low voltages, for the longest period before breakdown, it will remain uncorrelated. It is the voltage that gives you the correlation. So, the thing is that this is really a linear plot. Actually, what is happening, as the defects are forming, this black line is not flat. If you plot it in a log plot, you'd see tiny jumps in the current as individual defects are forming. Now, this method, this silk method, will catch everybody which is approximately in the middle of the oxide. So if you have a 2 nanometer oxide, it will catch people defects which are around 1 nanometer. If it is a 5 nanometer, it will catch around 2.5 nanometer in the middle. And I want to explain to you that, because this is something, it's very interesting how it works out. So the black line is really not flat. It's gradually going up. And that method will be, that approach can be used to get the defect number. So this is how it works. What you do, you stress it. You stress it for time duration, T1, T2, 1 second, 10 second, 100 seconds. And periodically, all you do, there's no back contact, no other contact. All you do is you drop the gate voltage to a measurement voltage. And this dropping is very important. You drop it, measure the current. And that current is directly proportional to the number of defects in the measurement level. Why? This is why. You may remember in 606 or the courses like that, I have often talked about diode characteristics having different regions. In the forward bias characteristics, I've told you that generally the ideal characteristics will be this black line, which has a 60 millivolts per decade, that type of slope, right? Generally for a current. This is tunneling current, no problem. That's fine. However, just like in diode, diode had the early part, which has a half the slope. You remember? Half the slope. And that region, what does it reflect? Electron and hole coming in the depletion region, recombining in the repletion region. It goes halfway and then it recombines. There is no diode here. You see, this is just a normal oxide, two contacts. So, but if you do the measurement, so you are stressing it at high voltage. When you are stressing at high voltage, you don't see anything. The current looks almost the same. But every time you stop and come down in the measurement voltage, what you will see the blue line in the beginning, then the green line, and as a function of time, this curve will keep going up. And that is proportional to the number of defects you have. Why there is this half the curve and all those, I'll explain in a second. Physics is related or similar to the diode, but not really the same. So I'll explain how that works. So this is always half the slope. Half the slope of the original curve, original black curve, the tail at low voltages. Now, why don't you see any effect of this in a high voltage? The reason it's a log plot. So therefore, this blue line, blue tail, if you extrapolate it, that extra contribution essentially disappears in a log plot when you go to high voltage. So therefore, you will not see anything in the measurement voltage. I'm sorry, stress voltage. Stress voltage, same current looks like. But on the low voltage, you will have very nice systematic buildup of blue and then red. I'm sorry, green, and then continued on. So where does it come from? Now, this is something you have studied a lot in various courses at Purdue, like 656 and also 659, where Professor Supriya Datta talks about transport through structures. And so I'm going to use exactly the same formulation. Let's start by thinking about direct tunneling current. Direct tunneling current involves the blue line on the top right, where the inversion electron can directly grow from the substrate to the gate. The two contacts are, what are the two contacts? One is the substrate, other is the gate. And what is the device? Oxide, quote unquote, oxide is the device. Ballistic channel. Oxide is the ballistic channel. So how will you calculate the current? You will say that the current is proportional to P direct. P direct is a transmission probability. You know how to solve Schrodinger equation. So you will know the transmission probability. FC is the cathode. Cathode means substrate, right? In this case, where the electron is coming. 1 minus FA and, it should have been FA 1 minus FC in the first line. Two fluxes. One goes from the left to right, other goes from the right to left. And once you subtract them out, you know this Fermi functions. It will essentially have FC minus FA. Or in the equivalently, you can say FC is like the inversion charges, right? Look at the picture on the right-hand side, inversion charges. And FA, what is the value of FA? It's close to zero. Because at that energy high up in the gate, nobody is occupied. On the other hand, what is FC? FC is close to one. Why? It's inversion, right? At that point is inversion. So essentially, everybody is going through. So you know this formula. The transmission coefficient, FC minus FA. That's the general current between two contacts. However, if you have a defect, then what's going to happen? Then you have to write two fluxes. One flux will go from the cathode to the trap, right? Just like before. Before it was going cathode to the anode. It goes to the cathode to the trap, just as before. And this is proportional to P1, the transmission coefficient up to the oxide. Up to the defect, because you don't have to go through the whole thing. And it depends on how many defects you have. Because if you have nothing, of course, there is no place for the electrons to sit. So therefore, it is proportional and capture cross-section and sigma. You know all those. So those are known. That's J1. Simplify, why FCFT will go away. So you simplify this. J2, I don't have to explain. J2 is essentially out-tunneling, electron tunneling out. Right? From the defect to the other side. Again, plus minus fluxes, you get the value. Now, the current must be continuous because when in steady state, electron coming in, electron getting out, these two, J1 must be equal to J2. If J1 is equal to J2, that's called stress-induced leakage current because without stress, there's no defect. And without defect, there's no current. There's no NOT and so therefore no current. If you equate these two, right? Then you can easily see that you can eliminate FT. And if you eliminate FT, you will have P1, P2 divided by P1, P2. And that's the new transmission coefficient for the stress-induced leakage current. Yes?
You are saying that J1 must equal J2, but why would you put a probability that electron captured inside the trap and doesn't go out?
But steady state flux, if somebody comes in and never gets out anywhere, then that cannot contribute to J1. J1 is a flux. It must change as a function of time. In the beginning, there will be a transient, right? dN dt is equal to J1 minus J2. But once the steady state, dN dt is zero. So J1 must be equal to J2. It's like water flowing in a pipe. Whatever you put in, on the output side, in the beginning you have to fill up the pipe. That's true. But once the pipe is filled up, whatever you put in must come out. Now, this is what I want to show. This will have half the slope as P direct. That's the surprising thing. Because here it looks like that it could be anything. Why is it half? And that's what I want to explain to you. Now, the transmission probability to the zeroth order, you may remember, it is essentially the integral of the wave vector, kx, and 0 to x, whatever the point you want to transmit to, and dx. You know, this is the transmission coefficient going under a barrier. If you have a sophisticated numerical solver, you will do it some other calculation, but it will be some function, exponentially, essentially, that depends on 0 to x. That's all we need to know. This exact form doesn't matter. Let's see how it works. So now I have those two expressions. J direct is the current at high voltage. That was the current. That's the black line. And I want to see the J silk, the low voltage thing, at low voltage, what that expression is. Now it is easy to show that, of course, you can write the direct tunneling current. Direct tunneling current goes from zero to TOX. The whole thing it has transmitted. You can easily break it into two pieces. Zero to the trap position to the rest of the oxide. Because this is just exponential. Exponential, you can split it any way you want. There is no problem. And so what is this equal to? P direct is equal to then always equal to P1 into P2. There is no P1 plus P2 on the bottom. But P direct, you can always write it in terms of P1 and P2. And similarly, so this is P1, 0 to the trap position. Xi and Xi prime are the relative fractions that the trap. Trap is, let's say, at 10 angstrom, and the whole thing is 30 angstrom. So 1/3 and 2/3. That's the Xi and Xi prime. So P1, P2, P1 plus P2. And so therefore, P1, P2 is P direct, and this one remains as is. You can easily show that this quantity goes down like this. The other quantity, P2, will go up like this. Why? Closer it is to the other side, the transmission coefficient will increase, right? And in the middle, both are good. Both are not too small. And in that case, the lowest, and in that case, this denominator will be minimum when P1 is equal to P2, right? Do you see why? Because in the beginning, if the defect is very close to this gate side, then P1 will be large, P2 will be very small, because it cannot get out. On the other hand, if it is on the other side, P1 will be minuscule, P2 will be very high because it can get out very quickly. In the middle, they balance. And when they balance, the flux is maximum.
So what is zeta prime?
Zeta prime is a fraction. So you remember 0 to the position of the oxide. So let's say you have a 3 nanometer oxide, right? And the defect is at 1 nanometer. This one will be then 1/3, because 0 to 10. And this one will be 0 to 20, the remaining piece. P2 is the remaining piece, right? So this is 0 to 2 nanometer, 0 to 1 nanometer, and this is P1 and P2. 1
to 3 nanometers.
1 to 3?
Like 0 to 1 and 1 to 3.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But this is exponential. So therefore, you can shift it. Right? This is an approximation, but you can shift it this way. And then, of course, if the electric field is varying quite a bit, then 1 to 3 and 0 to 1 are not the same. But what I'm just trying to say, that you can shift your origin and calculate whatever this quantity is. The main point is that the P1 goes down and the P2 picks up. And somewhere in between, depending on the exact calculation, whether it's exactly in the middle or slightly to the right or slightly to the left. Yeah, you know, that will depend on the exact calculation. Just one second. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess there is minus 1 in 2 exponential in order to be the same as the exponential minus all power minus 1 and all power minus 1. Then if you do the math, you will get the multiplication of them over the sum of them.
Okay, I'll let you work this out. Just let me see. I think it's okay, but maybe after the class we can go through this. Yeah, just because this is just algebra. So we'll discuss this. Because look at the top side is P1, P2. And you can see that if you shift the origin, the whole thing will become P direct. So we'll talk about this. This is just algebra. Maybe when you work it out, you'll see how it works. So let's look at that. So the J silk is P over 2. How did I get that? You see, if P1 is equal to P2, P1 is equal to P2, numerator P square, denominator 2P. And so it will become P over 2, right? It will become P over 2. That's what I have written on the right-hand side. The red P is how probability go half as much. So that's my tunneling probability, silk tunneling probability proportional to P. The direct tunneling current is proportional to P square. Why? P1 multiplied by P2. That gives me P square. So now do you see that whatever is the silk's voltage dependence, then that it will be half the voltage dependence of silk, of the direct tunneling current. Because I could always get the value of P and substitute in the other one. Whatever is the voltage dependence of the direct tunneling current, so if it is Q over KT, then this will be how much? Q over 2KT. And that's why this silk, the blue and the red line, these as the defects are forming, it's all proportional to NOT, number of defects. So as the defects are forming, then gradually this current will add to the red line, to the direct tunneling current. And when you sum them, you will only see them at low voltages. At higher voltages, it will not be able to compete with the direct tunneling current. And so therefore, you will not see them at higher voltages.
Voltage?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is indeed voltage. The x-axis is voltage. All right. But you got the idea, huh? Good. Go ahead.
So this NOT, is it giving me the number of traps close to the middle of the sand?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, only. But if I assume that the defect generation is more or less uniform, in that case, then you can say this to be a proxy. Just like charge pumping measurement gave you traps which are close to the middle of the gap. Any Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination gives you middle of this. And then you make an assumption about how the others are distributed. Here, what you are doing is essentially you are probing it close to the middle. And then whether the other pieces are the uniform or not, that's a additional calculation or additional measurement you may have to do. But I will show you some more. And then probably you'll see how people stitch up the whole thing and make this work. All right. Now, this is what the essential idea is, that therefore you see that when you add this silk current, then gradually it will show up in the total current measurement. Therefore, you have to come down and stress it at, measure it at low voltage. You cannot do it at high voltage. This, therefore, will not work very well for NBTI type thing, which relaxes. As soon as you come down to low voltages, the defect you're trying to measure will disappear. But of course, in this case, CDDB, silicon oxygen bond dissociation. So therefore, hopefully this will not relax too much. So I can catch it by this method. These are experiments. And I just wanted to show you some data just so that you know how this works. On the left-hand side, you can see 3.5 to 6.5. It's the axis is going from the right to the left. And you can see the original black line. Do you see this? This is the direct tunneling current. And why there is a noise? It's about 10 to the power 12 amp per centimeter square, a relatively low current. Generally, these transistors are 100 micron by 100 micron. And the limit of current, do you remember from Masood gave a talk? What is the limit of a prober station? Anybody remembers? It cannot be 10 to the power minus 19, right? Because 10 to the power minus 19 amp would mean one electron. You generally need about 100,000 electron or more in order to make reliable measurements. So it will be 10 femtoamp at the minimum. 10 femtoamp or so. So you can see that this is on that limit. So therefore, you are seeing the noise. And do you see half the slope? Do you see the half the slope? And this will keep increasing. Now, what about this one on the right? This is a little bit strange because it is showing the half slope even for the black curve. What does it mean? Can anyone tell me? Remember the red is, this is initial, black is initial. After a while, the curve went up because new defects were generated. And from this gap, you can calculate how many defects are generated. But why is the black line has also the slope? Pre-existing defects. So these oxides looks like it had a large number of pre-existing defects. So therefore, if you extrapolated it, that will be your ideal curve. This would be your pre-existing defects. So this is a very good way to see your quality of the oxide that you initially have. Now, what will happen at very low voltages or very thin oxides is that you cannot do silk measurement. Why not? You see, if you have a thick oxide, then your direct tunneling current, the black line, is low. And so therefore, the blue line and the green line, they can surface above the black line. But assume you have a very thin oxide, 1 nanometer. If you have a very thin oxide, then there is the direct tunneling current will be sitting there on the top. And so therefore, there is no way that this blue and green is ever going to show up. No matter how what voltage you are, even you are at 0.2 volts, you're not going to see anything because the direct tunneling current is so much bigger. So what you have to do, somehow cut out the direct tunneling current. Then you can see it. So how do you cut out the green tunneling, tunneling current is what I would like to show you. So the method is something like this. What you do, you apply during measurement. What type of transistor this is, by the way? Can you tell me? This one is on the right-hand side. Substrate is P substrate. So this is an NMOS. Does it make sense? The gate in NMOS is N-type and substrate is P-type. So what I'm doing here, I want to, generally, how would I have stressed this transistor? I would have applied a positive bias, right? Because the voltage would have been down. I want to invert it. But when you are doing measurement, you not only have to reduce the voltage, you have to go in the opposite direction, a little bit. Opposite direction, a little bit, right? Now you are measuring it at negative VG. Now when you do that, you can immediately see what will happen, that all the holes, all the electrons in the valence band cannot get out. Why? Because the band gap on the right-hand side will prevent them, right? There's no state. Going from here to here, there's no state. So therefore, all the direct current are completely suppressed. Now, what will happen if the voltage is a little bit, most of the current flow will have not go through the middle, but will step down through the red line, red dashed line, and then go tunnel directly through, and then recombine with the holes. Do you see the path? The electron is first coming down through the interface defect and then going to the other side to the interface defects and then recombining with the holes. What type of trap will this method detect? Will it detect middle of the gap? Not really, because this will just defect primarily the interface ones on two sides, this type of method. But if the bulk defect generation is proportional, more or less uniform, this method will also be a good indicator of the number of defects generated. And so take a look. Generally, people would do a measurement like this, low voltage cell, and look at that tiny, after the stress, the tiny red line, slightly larger than the black line. And from this, you can essentially just look at the difference. The difference on the left-hand slide between the red and the black at a given time is the number of defects that are generated. On the right-hand side, by changing the voltage a little bit between 0.5, plus 0.5 and minus 0.5, you essentially at low voltage, you can get the method by essentially coming down in the interface traps, tunneling, and going through the interface traps, recombining with the holes, you can find out exactly the number of defects that are being generated as a function of time. So this is similar to the DCIV method, very similar, but it is essentially connecting the two electrodes from the either side of the material. And people do these measurements very, very nicely. And so what you want to do is essentially take these values and plot it out as a function of time, will give you the universal curve. Right? So this is a method to track the quote-unquote bulk traps due to TDDB generation. Yes.
These different curves for different stress voltage for different times?
Each one of them is for different time.
Not different stress voltage.
No.
Stress voltage is the same.
Stress voltage is the same. So as you have different times, more defects are getting generated. And as the more defects are getting generated, this excess current, this stress-induced leakage current, is gradually going up.
Yeah. VG on the x-axis is the operating voltage?
No, the measurement voltage. Measurement voltage. Stress, you have to probably stressing at 3 volts, 4 volts, whatever. But generally, here, when you're doing the measurement, and you can see, as you go to the higher voltages, you lose all resolution. Because the direct tunneling current is so much bigger that you don't get much of a difference. And so therefore, you have to stay very close to this voltage, zero voltage, so that you suppress the direct tunneling current and you only see the stress-induced leakage current. And people do beautiful plots. Remember the flat line I showed you, right? In the linear plot, it was supposed to be flat. And I told you underneath this, there is this red line. This red line is sort of going underneath this. Gradually, as defects are forming, the red line is the silk-induced current as a function of time. And actually, if you do the measurement of that I just showed you, you will get for different stress voltages. These are 1.8, 1.7. These are different stress voltages. Beautiful curves. Now log-log plot, not a linear plot anymore. So you can see how the defects are forming. And this will form universal curve underneath. So therefore, reliability requires good measurement, like any branch of physics. If you want to get the, what is this, Higgs boson? Then you need a big collider, right? Lot of effort into generating the measurement equipment. So anytime you want to do ultra-precision physics, very good physics, you need very good measurements. And reliability is a very good way of sort of getting to that. And on the left-hand plot, what I'm showing is defects are forming at different random places, and the silk current is coming out perpendicularly. This is the top view of the oxide. Current is coming out of this. And you can, if you are careful, you will see even in the plots at 1.1 volts, there's this little tiny, if you blow it up, you will see individual defects forming as a little steps on that current. And essentially before breakdown, when there'll be a lot of defects forming and that lot of current jumping out, you can see the noise will begin to increase very much because as the different sets of electrons flying through, getting trapped, getting out, they are not all in synchronization. Direct tunneling current is synchronized. All of them tunneling together. Defect induced, they hop in. When they hop in, nobody else can come in. And then they hop out. And so therefore, you will see this noise build up towards the close to the breakdown point. Again, you can analyze those and see this. Okay. Now, one thing you have to be very clear. I showed you the plot on the right-hand side, right top. Look beautiful. But if you really go in the lab and do the measurement, you will get the plot on the left. Doesn't look as nice at all, right? It looks very different. How do you do this? So the way you have to remember that we had charging. When you defects get charged, it changes the threshold voltage. Do you remember? And do you remember what was this shift in the characteristics was like? Do you remember trapping in the pre-existing trap? What was the characteristics like? Log T. Do you remember that log T? And as you're trapping more, your VT was going up, your current was going down. So this black line is the log T. So what you have to do, take the left-hand plot, subtract off all the log T, because that's not tunneling current. That's charging current in the pre-existing defects, right? Remember the dndt, the thing that we're talking about? This is that charging time. So you have to subtract it off. Once you subtract it off, then you will get all those beautiful results. You have to subtract this and all these curves will then show up on the right-hand side. So therefore, this has to be done very, very nicely in order before the actual physics sort of floats up. Now, let me tell you the last piece. So these defects, these approaches have told us number of defects. But we don't know exactly where the energy level of the defect is. The CV method didn't tell us because we filled them up. If they are up or if they are down, I cannot say much. On this particular one, if the level, so long the level is aligned with the electron Fermi level, the trapping will happen. But that level could be anywhere in between. And this is very important. I'll show you why. But this is called a quantum yield experiment that will tell you where the defect is, like this particular way. So this is how it works. Assume that you are injecting some electrons on the top and the electrons are ballistic. And so that will be the topmost blue electron that will come out. And when it does so, it will have a lot of energy. And so it will impact ionize, right? And so what will happen? You will have more red points if it comes out ballistic. But let's say for some reason, the defect is such that it catches the electron, reorganizes itself because its charge state has changed, and it lets the electron go at a lower level. Let's say. So it is like when you are going in the elevator. You come at the 8th floor and you exit at the 4th floor. That is what this defect is doing by reorganizing, emitting at a different level. How would you know? You cannot go inside and with the STM or AFM go and ask that what reorganization is too small. However, you can immediately check how many red electrons or red holes it has produced. If for the same current, fewer red holes have been produced, then you must know that the energy has been lost during the transit, right? And so this is something is very important. This ratio of the number of blue electrons to number of red holes is called quantum yield. By looking at the quantum yield ratio, then you can essentially say whether the electron defect relaxed or it stayed in the same position. So how would you do this experiment? Very, very simply. So what you do is that it could be an NMOS or PMOS, doesn't matter. You apply a negative bias on the gate. If you apply a negative bias from the gate, which direction electron flow? It will go from the gate to the substrate. Once it comes out of the substrate, then this black arrow, then it will impact ionize. Which direction do you think the holes will go? And which direction do you think the electrons will go? The electrons will go out direct, but the holes will be collected by the source and drain. Do you understand why? You can take a look at this picture. On the left, on the right-hand side, the black electron is coming from the gate to the substrate. After it has impact ionized, the electron will flow out through the substrate. But the holes cannot flow out through the substrate. It's a p-n-type material. Holes will get out through source and drain. So just by measuring the amount of gate current you have relative to the source and drain current you have, then you can say what was the electron energy that it came out with. So this is called a carrier separation method, because by you're separating the carriers, one group goes to the electrons goes to the substrate, the other group comes out through source and drain. And this will tell you whether this process is elastic or inelastic. Elastic means it lost low energy when it is coming through. Inelastic means it lost some energy and then it went out. So it will tell you, allow you to differentiate. So I'll show you some experiments. But you understand the methodology, right? Yes.
In this case, like if the holes can also recombine with the electrons in the bulk silicon before they...
Very good point. Absolutely. So what he is saying that if the electron recombines with the holes, so in that case, of course, you did not get the true ratio. So most of the time, therefore, you cannot do this experiment with a very long channel that will enhance the recombination. What you want is that this channel length is relatively small so that it preferentially goes to the left and right rather than getting recombined. The second thing is, remember, where will the most of the impact ionization will happen? Very close to the interface, because they, when they just came out, they had the maximum energy. So they will happen very close to this inversion region. And so that will quickly separate them out. Of course, if they get into the bulk, they will all recombine, but they are not going to get into the bulk. It will much before that, it is going to impact ionize. So for example, the TAT means trap-assisted tunneling. Quantum yield is gives you the number of holes generated per injected electron. So you see IG is what? Number of electrons that came in. I source and drain is what? Number of holes that were generated. And so in the beginning, you may not have much of these pre-existing defects. The quantum yield, as you are going from, let's start from minus 2.5 volts, as you are going to 5.5 volts, the quantum yield is increasing. Have you seen this curve before? Do you remember in the last class, I said that the impact ionization, right? There's the gamma II, the impact ionization. What was that high value, what is the impact ionization number? Between 1 to 3, remember? So this is what you are seeing, that it's saturating close to 1 on the high voltages. And at low voltages, it's falling off. What was the fall off, do you remember? Exponential, exactly. It was exponential of dV. Do you remember? And so this is what I wrote, right? Gamma II. There's a constant, of course. This is what I wrote. This is that tip. So this is clearly showing you how the impact ionization is reducing as you are reducing the gate voltage, of course. Right? That makes perfect sense. And you can do simulation and experiment, and those will match up very, very nicely.
The earlier experiment, is the source and drain grounded?
Source and drain are grounded.
So, the whole currents should cancel out, because half of them will prefer to go to source and half of them will prefer to go to drain. So, even if the channel length is short, the net current should be zero, because half of them are going to source.
No, but you can just measure the source current separately. You don't have to measure the drain current separately. Only when you combine them, then of course the current will be zero. Or you can float the drain. That is also a possibility, and let everybody go to the source. But you are right. If you sum them, of course they came from two different sides. Very good question. And so you just look at the one component of the current, then it should be fine. Now you see the funny thing. In the fresh oxide, low voltage on this side, high voltage on this side. In the fresh oxide, you have the black line. So why is the black line that characteristics? Because everybody was tunneling current. Tunneling current was coming in, and therefore, elastic, lot of energy, high impact ionization. So that's the black line. Now, after a little bit later, defects will begin to form. And as the defect begins to form, you will see that the excess current, this is delta I, the excess current, the red and the green, essentially what will happen, that the excess current, it's not the original current, it's a difference from what you had originally, minus what you have now, minus the original. And what you will see, the impact ionization efficiency has gone down significantly. And so this was a remarkable finding. It says that every electron it catches, you lose about 1 eV before it comes out. And so this trap-assisted process is actually a very remarkable process. It allows the trap to relax before allowing it to emit. And so therefore, what will happen that even when you have a large amount of defect generation, the number of holes that it will create will generally be very, very low, because it has come out at a much lower energy. So this is about 1 to 1.5 eV. In fact, none of the traps allows elastic transport. And many times when you do physics, we'd make a model that you catch something and let it go at the same energy. In fact, it essentially will always catch it, these defects in oxide, relax it and allow it to go, thereby creating a very few number of holes. And so therefore, you can see why in thin oxides things are uncorrelated. Do you understand why? The reason what's happening, there's a lot of defects are forming. The total current is going up quite a bit. But these are very inefficient current because they are coming out at a very low energy. And so therefore, they cannot localize damage. The original damage is still happening through the direct tunneling current. Do you understand this? The excess ones essentially are not, cannot create new holes. And so essentially you can either do the silk experiment, that's fine, or you can do the quantum yield experiment. Essentially, in both cases, you will get the correlation. You can, how many defects are generated, at what energy levels they are being generated at. And from that information, you can get the defect generation probability in gate dielectrics. So, let me conclude here then. So, I said that there is a set of new techniques, right? There are, which are the new techniques? This is a pulse CV. It is not a normal CV. The normal CV we have done before. You just look at the shift in the CV characteristics or the subthreshold. So, I've told you about three new methods. And I'm promising you there will not be too many new. There will be probably one or two methods and then we will not discuss about these methods anymore. But these are the most important methods widely used. Silk is used to do what? Mid-gap, mid-states, or not mid-gap. Mid-thickness traps, approximately. And quantum yield is supposed to do what? Energy level. At what energy level does the electron come out? Because I can look at the number of holes that I have generated, know how hot the electrons were. And thereby I can find out that's why they happen. And it's very important. This is the heart of correlated and uncorrelated breakdown. You will see later. I have told you before, low voltage silk generally probes close to the interface. But you need traps on both interfaces, on this side and the other side. Because otherwise, if you have just NBTI like one interface degradation, this one will not catch it. Because essentially you need both traps to grow, and therefore it's related to bulk traps. Now, this is very important for thin oxides. For slightly normal thicker oxides, you can use the classical silk method. Can you tell me, for very thick oxide, why can you not use silk? Probability is too low. There is no direct tunneling current. And if there is no direct tunneling current, stress-induced leakage current, the thickness is just too big, so you cannot see it. So therefore, of course, you cannot use this method. Then you can use CV method, no problem. And I told you about the native traps, most of the pre-existing traps, for some reason, these are elastic, but any stress-induced leakage, new defects that are formed by violent electron-hole recombination, those turn out to be all inelastic. They catch at one energy, they release at lower energy. Just one second. Let me finish. And the low frequency charge pumping, you can always use it. Low frequency meaning few kilohertz, maybe a kilohertz or so. And then you should correlate with silk and quantum yield experiment. This is very important that you, anytime you have a result, this is a very important result because many people, your company will rely on your ability to make a correct prediction. And therefore, if you just use one technique because you learned it in school, just one technique, many times you can make a dangerous mistake. So it's always a good idea to catch the same phenomena by two, three different approaches, right? Many of these, as I said, are available in existing simulators, so therefore, existing machines, so therefore it's not complicated.